Tomorrow is Election Day for many of Illinois' cities and towns. Voters across the state will choose their local leaders, with mayoral and city council races in some of our biggest cities, including Chicago, Champaign, and Springfield. Plus, we'll revisit our conversation with Brian Wallach. He was diagnosed with ALS a little more than a year ago. Since that time, he's been trying to raise $100 million to help find a cure for the 20,000 Americans who currently have it.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up, people with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease live an average of just 2 to 5 years. And today, one man who was diagnosed about a year ago is trying to raise $100 million to try to find a cure for future generations. We'll be revisiting that conversation later in the hour. But first, in the world of national politics, many people are already talking about 2020. But there's another election day much closer to home that's taking place tomorrow. Cities and towns across the country will elect their local leaders in tomorrow's municipal elections. Here in Illinois, these elections include some of our largest cities, including Chicago, Springfield, Champaign, and the Bloomington-Normal area. We'll bring you the results of those elections on Wednesday morning, including Chicago's mayoral race, where the city will elect its first ever female African-American leader. But today, we wanted to focus on central Illinois, starting with Champaign, which is electing a mayor, city councilors, and school board members. Kristen Walters is the engagement strategist for Illinois Newsroom. She organized a series of community events with voters in central Illinois, and she's with us now in our Urbana studios. Kristen, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you so much, Brian.
There are certainly a lot of candidates for a lot of different offices, whether it's mayor, city council, or school board. We don't have time to get to all of them, so we're going to focus on a few issues. Kristen, as I mentioned, you organized several community events designed to engage voters across central Illinois, including in Champaign. Before we get to the issues that were brought up, can you tell us a little bit about what you do and how you wanted to approach this local election, especially here in Champaign?
Sure. So, you know, as engagement strategist, that's a fancy title, but it simply means that I just create ways that our newsroom can talk to the community more and get feedback from the community so that we can focus our reporting on the things that most matter to them, because we want to make sure that what we report on is what people want to know. And that's really very important as the elections come up, right? So we took that very seriously. We wanted to make sure that we focused our election coverage on what would help people vote confidently so that they really could get a sense of where candidates stood on the issues that they cared about. And the only way that we could know exactly what people cared about was to talk to them about it. So we had that event at Parkland in mid-March where we focused about on community violence specifically as part of the conversation. And that's just because it had been coming up a lot in a lot of community discussions. And so we wanted to have a focused conversation about that.
Sure. So about that issue of community violence, you know, that was the kind of the centerpiece of the event in Champaign. What did you hear specifically about community violence from voters during that event?
Well, I think what was really interesting is that it was clear that gun violence is just a symptom of many issues in the community. So if you actually are to look at the questionnaire that came out of this event, what people really wanted to know, there was a variety of things that they felt affected safety in a community. Something as, you know, seemingly small as having more lights in a neighborhood to something as big as having more jobs available and having more job training.
Very good. And I think voters have two choices in the race for mayor, incumbent Deborah Frank Finan and Azark David Cobbs. What was the issue you heard about the most from community members for that mayoral race in particular?
Yeah, I think for the mayoral race with the, you know, somebody who's really going to be highly visible in the community, people, especially people in from neighborhoods that are lower socioeconomic status, from North Champaign and from Northwest Champaign, they really wanted their main leader to be more present in their communities. They really wanted their main, the mayor to show up in their communities, come to their community events, be available to them, and build a little bit more trust in those communities. So that was something that we heard often.
And you mentioned before we went on the air that residents also cared about communication mm-hmm. with their elected officials.
Yeah.
What specifically about communication? You mentioned, you know, being present, being visible. What about communication?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a tricky subject, because a lot of the candidates and a lot of, you know, current sitting council people are like, look, we have a public email address. You can email us whenever. But I think that people really want to feel a call to be communicated with, right? They want their leadership to reach out to them rather than waiting for people to kind of feel inspired to email them.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think really they wanted more proactive communication. You know, people wanted them to kind of build maybe newsletters or have better messaging about what they were doing for the city. So that was something that came up often.
And last thing here, Kristen, Champaign-Urbana is, of course, home to the University of Illinois. In any community with a big college presence, the relationship between a university and the town plays a big role. What did you hear about that?
I think that there is some tension, well, particularly about the conversation around community violence, because the city of Champaign is really trying to rally as much support to fight against violence in the community. And there's a disconnect where the University of Illinois really doesn't want to engage. They don't want to be part of that messaging, right? They don't want people, potential students thinking that they're in an unsafe community. So there's a little resistance and it's a little tricky to figure out how can we actually work together. So there's tension there.
Very good. Kristen Walters, the engagement strategist with the Illinois Newsroom. Kristen, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo, and we're talking about municipal elections in central Illinois. In cities all over the state, voters are choosing their local leaders. We just heard a little bit about Champaign. Now let's turn to Springfield. Mary Hansen has been covering this for our partner station, NPR Illinois, and she joins us now from their studios. Mary, welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get to some of the issues that you've been covering, Mary, we often hear the word Springfield as a shorthand for state government in both politics and in the press. Is there a sense that state politics tends to overshadow local politics?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, state government's definitely sort of a fact of life in Springfield. You know, the kind of ebb and flow of activity in the downtown during the week tends to track with, you know, session when the lawmakers and lobbyists and folks like that are in town. At the same time, many of the, you know, candidates and city officials are also state government workers or even retired state government workers. So, and there's sort of a sense that you have to be kind of more conversant perhaps in understanding issues related to state government to hold office in Springfield. And then, of course, there's a sort of partisanship that kind of, you know, as we say with a lot of local election coverage, you know, these races are technically nonpartisan, but of course in Springfield that's a very difficult thing to do. So a lot of that kind of partisanship spills over into the local elections as well.
And Mary, we've talked on the show before about the west side of Springfield versus the east side. The east side of the city gets less investment and is predominantly black. And in fact, an investigation by Governing Magazine found that income inequality between black and white residents in Springfield was greater than anywhere in the whole country. What have candidates said about both that issue and about that investigation specifically?
Yeah, so candidates have been asked sort of several times in different forums and things about this investigation, about sort of segregation in Springfield. And some of the reaction has been varied, although a sort of common refrain, a common sort of reaction to this has been, well, we just need more economic development and we need more and better jobs. Although, as often happens with campaigns, sometimes the specifics are a little light, but definitely some of the reaction, a lot of the reaction has been we need more more jobs. I was at a candidate forum last week, and the candidates were asked about this, and one of the candidates to represent the north end of Springfield, Ward 4, he questioned the findings of this investigation and sort of said, you know, people of color that he knew, they would get preferential treatment, and talked about the need for parents of kids to be sort of better role models. And another candidate at that forum, Lakeisha Purchase, who's running to represent downtown, she said she found that and a couple of the other comments pretty disturbing or disrespectful. And she said it's really more of an issue of addressing systemic racism, which can be a difficult and uncomfortable conversation to have. So I think people are talking about it in different ways, and it seems to be a good time to be having that discussion.
And Mary, of course, local elections are a chance to really focus on specific areas of a city. And what parts of Springfield have been talked about the most often?
I mean, definitely downtown. Downtown revitalization is always a big issue in Springfield. You know, there's been sort of a perennial issue with the North Mansion or the Y Block, the block right across from the Governor's Mansion, with the city, which the city has owned for several years and has been trying to figure out what to do with. So that's always an issue. And then, you know, as you mentioned, the East Side and East Side development and investment always tends to be another one that comes up.
Mary Hansen has been covering the Springfield elections for NPR Illinois. Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're talking about local elections in central Illinois and wanted to end with Bloomington and Normal today. I'm joined by Ryan Denham, a reporter with our partner station at WGLT in Normal. They've been covering local races for city council in both Bloomington and Normal. Ryan, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Should note right here that WGLT's general manager, R.C. McBride, is a member of the Normal Town Council and is running for re-election, but McBride does not have an editorial role at WGLT or the production of the 21st. Ryan, both Bloomington and Normal are electing city or town council members tomorrow. When you look back on the last few years, what have been the most contentious issues to come before the city council in both places?
So it kind of differs between the two communities. In Normal, I think it's certainly been, you know, questions of economic development and the redevelopment of Uptown Normal, which is sort of the central business district. You know, there's all these questions about how close the town of Normal should work with private developers, you know, what incentives to give, what tax breaks to give. And the current incumbents on the town council have been attacked by both kind of the left and the right over those relationships between the town and private developers. In Bloomington, it's a little more varied. I think there have been several social issues that have sort of come up in the last few years, immigration and how local police should treat immigrants, what police community relations should look like. Those have been pretty hot social issues. And then spending priorities in Bloomington are always sort of a big question mark. There's been a kind of a reluctance to take any big swings when it comes to major city-funded projects for the last 10 years or so, ever since the city-owned arena opened, and that has had kind of a bad public reputation, and I think that sort of held things up a little bit on some of these other larger projects.
Ryan, something we've talked about with you before is Rivian, the electric vehicle company that took over the former Mitsubishi plant. How are local leaders feeling overall about economic development in the area?
Well, I think the Rivian case study is really interesting. There's certainly a lot of optimism around Rivian here locally ever since Amazon announced a pretty major investment in the company. There's a certain legitimacy that I think Rivian has picked up. So that's, you know, maybe opened the door or raised increased openness to tax breaks as a result of having that kind of positive experience. But I think it's a little too soon to say whether or not that's any kind of permanent thing. I mean, Rivian really hasn't even started to hire yet. And so locally, and so it's a little too soon to say that those tax breaks have worked like a charm. And, you know, that if that takes off and that goes really well, yeah, that could change the conversation locally around economic development. But another thing that's happened recently is the city of Bloomington has created its own economic development department, assigning, you know, full-time staff to work on the issue. So it's top of mind here.
Bloomington Normal, of course, the home to Illinois State University and Illinois Wesleyan. How much do these two colleges and universities come up in local elections?
Quite a bit. It's you know, on the Normal Town Council side, one of the eight candidates running is a student named Alex Campbell. He, if he's elected, it's believed to be the first student who'd ever serve on the council. At ISU, it adds sort of a certain amount of progressive energy to the local political community. You've got you know, students who are engaged usually with the ISU Democrats who are volunteering and working for local political campaigns. So you see a lot of young people out there campaigning for candidates that they've fallen in love with. And it's, yeah, it's a lot of energetic folks here involved.
We asked Mary about what specific areas of Springfield are of greatest concern to local voters and candidates. What about in Bloomington and in Normal?
I think sort of the obvious answer would be downtown Bloomington and uptown Normal. Downtown Bloomington is, I think it's perceived publicly to be sort of in a challenging time right now. They've had some major, buildings that have become vacant, and development has been a little slower over the last 10 years. But they've had some good news recently, too, so that's maybe on the verge of turning around. And then in Uptown Normal, they've got a major redevelopment underway and has been underway for 10, 15 years. But there are questions now about, how much town money has been put into it and, the amount of money that private developers have made and will make off of those projects. And so those are the two physical spaces that are sort of at the most interesting moments, I think, as the election comes around.
All right, we'll see what happens in those municipal elections tomorrow. Ryan Denham with our partner station WGLT in Normal. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thanks, Brian.
And don't forget to vote in your local elections tomorrow. As always, the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights will have legal volunteers ready to answer the phones if you run into any problems at your local polling place or if you just have some questions. That number is 866-OUR-VOTE. That's 866-687-8683. They also have hotlines in 9 languages, including Spanish, Mandarin, and Arabic. We'll tweet out those numbers if you follow us on Twitter at 21STShow. Stay with us. Coming up after the break, we'll revisit a conversation with Brian Wallach, whose organization, I Am ALS, is trying to raise $100 million to help find a cure for this disease. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
From Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Emphatic, American Painting from the Collection, featuring art by Louise Fishman, Mark Rothko, Purvis Young, and more, on view now through May 12th. More at kam.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. What do you think of when you hear ALS? Maybe Lou Gehrig or the Ice Bucket Challenge come to mind. But even though it's estimated that about 20,000 Americans are living with ALS, beyond that, many of us don't know much or anything about the disease. Brian Wallach was first diagnosed with ALS in November of 2017 at age 37. He was given 6 months to live. Today, he and his wife are fighting for a cure through his organization, I Am ALS. Nyla had a chance to speak with Brian back in February at the Illini Center in downtown Chicago.
Brian, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into what you're doing, probably I think the first question a lot of people always probably ask you is, how are you doing?
And it's a great question. As you'll find when you meet more people with ALS, there is a broad spectrum of answers to that. For me, thankfully, I can sit here today and say, I'm on the slower progressing side of the spectrum. So what that means in my day-in-day-out life, my hands are weaker, my voice is a bit different than what you would have heard a few years ago, and I'm no longer able to run the 6.5-minute mile that I could run in college. I was actually a 400 runner in college. Running a 20-minute mile now is a pretty good thing, but all things considered, I'm able to do pretty much everything I have been for years. So I'm one of the lucky ones in that respect, because many folks who have ALS actually are at this point in wheelchairs or incapacitated, or a large part have actually passed away, which is part of the difficulty of this disease.
And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about what ALS actually is, because I think that's a big education point for a lot of people, myself included. I was doing some research knowing you were coming in, but I think a lot of people in passing know, okay, that's Lou Gehrig's disease and maybe not much more than that.
Yeah, which was where I was actually before I was diagnosed. You know, if you'd asked me 4 years ago what I knew about ALS, I'd say Lou Gehrig, ice bucket, not good. Now, you know, to actually answer the question, I know a lot more. And in short, what ALS does is it basically stops your brain from talking to each part of your body over time. So depending on where your ALS onset starts, you can lose your speech, you can lose functionality in your hands, you can lose the capacity to actually use your legs. And over the course of the disease, you'll actually see functionality decline in every other part of your body. And what happens is ALS patients are kind of left as prisoners in their own body. Their mind typically is often sharp, so you can see all this, you know what's happening, but you can't stop it. And then ultimately, unfortunately, you pass away due to respiratory failure. So obviously it sounds grim because it is, but part of what we are hoping to do through conversations like ours is help educate people about what ALS is, but also about the possibility of finding a cure, which is now a real possibility. And the more amazing thing that I've learned over the last year and a half is that if we cure ALS, it may actually unlock cures to Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, other diseases that obviously affect even more people out there and have the potential to really change the world.
I want to ask you about that in a minute, but I wonder if you would mind sharing for us what it was like when you got your diagnosis and your, not just that initial diagnosis, but then also your education and how you learned about this, because I think your reaction to this is maybe a little bit different than other people in the way that you have created this organization and you flew all over the country talking to doctors and asking them what they needed. I wonder if you can share a little bit of that with us.
I think the best thing to say is immediately you feel very alone because you built a life that you think is sort of the way it will be and should be. And all of a sudden that is ripped away from you. You know, during the course of our conversation here today, a few people, you know, listening may have friends or family that are diagnosed with ALS. And so the most important thing I can say that we took away from our year of travels is you're not alone. There are a lot of people out there that are working on this, that are trying to find a cure. The patient community is an incredible, vibrant community. It's one that will bring you in. It's one that will try to help you in every way possible. But when you get that diagnosis, and for us, we'd actually just come home with our second daughter the day that I was diagnosed initially, you can't help but feel like all is lost. And so what we did, and what I hope many out there will do, is we researched. We found everything that we could, and we then brought that to doctors. And we, you know, got second opinions to make sure that we were getting the best advice possible, because in a fight like this, you have to be your own advocate. Obviously, it's really important to seek out the advice of those who know what they're doing, but you should educate yourself because you're going to find a lot of crazy ideas out there. You're going to find a lot of good ideas out there, and having friends, family, doctors who can help guide you through this is really important because, as one doctor said to me, you're not going to be gone tomorrow. You're going to be here for a while, so get ready for that.
And I wonder, when you're thinking about this, through this, you've learned a lot about ALS. I mean, what do you think do you think there are misconceptions out there that, first of all, people that you want to, any myths you want to dispel?
Yes. I think there are two big ones that I should start with. One is ALS, like cancer, can affect anyone. Any race, any age, any gender, any sex, it doesn't discriminate. I think people often think of ALS as affecting a particular small subset of folks. If that were true, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you because I'm about 25 years younger than the average ALS onset case. That is one thing that's important because when we realize that ALS can affect everyone, it also helps us understand that curing it does take everyone. The second piece that I would want to make sure to dispel is that ALS is often talked about as a rare disease, and it's true in the sense that there aren't that many people living with ALS, but part of the reason that there aren't that many is because, unfortunately, they pass away so quickly. It amazed me to find out that ALS and multiple sclerosis are diagnosed at the same rate. But when you think about multiple sclerosis, you know far more people because, thankfully, and this is an amazing thing, they're able to live often longer with the actual disease. ALS, that number that you started off with, that 20,000, you know, most folks think that's low. And obviously, if we were able to live for a longer period of time, you would have a much higher number.
My guest is Brian Wallach. He has founded an organization called I Am ALS. And I want to just touch on something you said, because you mentioned cancer, and you said that ALS can affect anyone just like cancer could. But I wonder why you think ALS is less funded, less understood, less known than cancer.
I actually think that the parallel to cancer is one that has really kind of taken hold, at least in my brain and many doctors that I've talked to, in the sense that ALS is kind of like what cancer was back in the 1960s. So we didn't know much about it then. We didn't really have many treatments at that point in time. And so, you know, when you got a cancer diagnosis, that was a really, really difficult thing for a family. And often doctors would tell you, much like they do with ALS now, get your affairs in order. What has changed, and what is an amazing thing when you look at cancer, when you look at the fight against HIV/AIDS, is that there's been decades of research that has moved us inexorably forward towards the point where we can't treat every type of cancer, but we have weapons in the arsenal to actually, you know, fight back against these illnesses that, you know, can take your life so quickly. And I think we are at that tipping point with ALS. I know you mentioned the Ice Bucket Challenge a few minutes ago. For many people, that was probably the first time, outside of, you know, knowing the name Lou Gehrig, that they ever heard the letters ALS. That was a huge moment, because it brought attention, it brought money, and it brought research into the ALS space. And over the last 5 years, there's been an explosion in the identification of ALS genes, in new trials, in the possibility of actually finding a cure. And so my hope is that what we're starting here can help ensure that if we have this conversation in 10 years, we can say, look at all the progress that we're made.
So when we think about that, the goal of I Am ALS is to fundraise, because you want to fundraise and find a cure for ALS. How much are you hoping to raise?
So we have set a small goal of raising $100 million over the next 3 years. And I think to break that down a bit, because people talk about fundraising for diseases all the time. What we are really looking at is, my wife and I met on the political campaign back in 2008. And for us, a big part of our experience is understanding community and how community can be so important to helping change a narrative. And so what we want to be able to do is help empower the patients, the caregivers that are living with this fight, to have the mental space, to have the capacity to become leaders in the fight. And in doing so, we hope to be able to introduce them to those of you listening to this show that have never met someone with ALS. And our hope is that when you meet them, you'll want to get involved. And that could mean posting something on social media, that could mean hosting a party, that could mean helping them go to the grocery store one day. And our hope is that eventually you'll see that, you know, this community is really an incredible one, and that you'll be able to give to us to actually help accelerate that fight for a cure. So our goal is really to transform the discussion from a, you know, idea of help us by strictly donating to join us, become a part of this movement, become the change that we need to make a cure real.
So you mentioned you and your wife met on a political campaign, and you actually worked in the Obama administration for a while before your lawyer, right? Before coming back to Chicago and being in, and now you're in private practice now?
I am. So I was in the White House for 2 years, went back to private practice, and then was a assistant United States attorney actually in Chicago for 4 years.
I wonder how you think that background has informed you now creating this organization.
It's a great question. I think that the experiences that we carry with us from that time are twofold. One is, it shows you the importance of actually listening, and not just listening, but really seeking out opinions that may differ from yours to understand how you can better actually produce a solution that will help everyone. So the ALS space has a tremendous amount of great groups, great advocates in it already. It's not like we are the first group out there. And so for us, it was really important to be able to go to them understand what they're doing and how we can actually help so that we don't simply do the same thing again and again, but actually augment the incredible work that they're doing now to get more people involved in this fight. And I think the second lesson that I took really from those days was never underestimate the power of asking a question. Often in fights like this in particular, we will accept the first answer that's given to us because we don't have the capacity to push past it. But if you ask why, if you ask how, if you find yourself actually there getting engaged, it's amazing what you can help accomplish and help drive forward. And that is something that, you know, I want to believe I've known my entire life, but I think crystallized over the course of the last 5 or 6 years for me.
We're talking with Brian Wallach about IMALS. And Brian, I wonder, when you were first diagnosed in 2017, I imagine this question of this organization was not a question you were probably asking immediately.
That's correct. And, you know, immediately, the first thing I thought of was I want to get a bigger iPhone so I can take more videos from my daughter in case I'm not, or daughters in case I'm not here when they're older. But after a few weeks of crying, a few weeks of wondering why, we actually met an amazing doctor who said to my wife, I have good news and I have bad news. Bad news is I can't tell you that your husband doesn't have ALS. Good news is he's going to be around for a while, so get used to him. And the better news is you guys, you know, if you want to, can dive into this space and try to make a difference. You know, he then added, I don't know what that is, but I know that you know, the worst thing you can do is not try.
So that's kind of one of the thing. That's one of the many things about ALS is that even the diagnosis itself isn't necessarily immediately clear or apparent. You and I were talking before we went on air. I was sharing with you my breast cancer diagnosis 2 years ago and what I went through, and that you find out right away. Like, it's pretty quick. They're just sort of like, you have cancer, and they tell you right away. That didn't even happen with you.
No, I mean, the diagnosis for ALS is one of exclusion. So you go into a doctor, the doctor says there are, you know, a number of things that you could have. One of them could be ALS. So we're going to go ahead and test you for everything from cancer to Lyme disease to, you know, autoimmune to multiple sclerosis. We're going to try to figure out if any of these other diseases are the cause of your symptoms. And when you get to the end of that road, there is one test that they do that can medically confirm an ALS diagnosis. It's called an EMG, where they basically stick your body with some needles and look at the muscles under the tissue level. And at that point, only after, I think for me, I was actually lucky, it was about 5 or 6 months. For many others, it's much longer. At that point is when they can finally tell you, yes, you have ALS.
So with this research that you are fundraising for, where do you see the most promising lines of research right now?
So the amazing part about my answer to that question is there's a lot. And that is what gives us hope. You know, that and the amazing people that we've met in this journey. There are some promising trials into stem cell work. There's some promising trials into different drug compounds. And, you know, for me, a cure means two things. It means we can either get a, you know, home run that reverses or stops everything, or like HIV, we can build a curative cocktail of drugs. And so in the short term, we know that there are a lot of drugs in the pipeline right now. If those drugs can get through trials into patients and actually help slow down their progression, that's an incredible thing. That's an incredible gift to an ALS patient. And so for us, we want to push as many drugs forward as fast as possible, helping drug companies and helping researchers get the actual capacity to build those drugs, helping patients to get into trials, and helping ultimately to get those drugs through approvals once they're proven effective into patients as quickly as we can. That's where the funding will go. And that is where we've been short all these years, is it takes a lot of money to take a drug from a concept to reality. And that initial phase where it's in the lab or researchers at universities are doing it, that's often funded through public grants and other sort of philanthropic efforts. That's where we can make a huge difference as IMALS and as a community.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Brian Wallach Chicagoan who has just started an organization called I Am ALS. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. If you're just joining us, we're revisiting a conversation we had in February with Brian Wallach. Back in 2017, Brian was diagnosed with ALS. At the time, he didn't really know what that meant for his health and for his future. Now, he's leading the charge for a cure. An Ipsos poll that came out last year found that more than 60% of Americans knew little about ALS. 85% did not know that the average lifespan is less than 5 years for those who are diagnosed. That poll was commissioned by Brian Wallach and his organization, I Am ALS. Nyla Boodoo spoke with Brian at the Illini Center in downtown Chicago.
Brian, so your goal with this organization is, as you said, you have a fundraising goal of $100 million over the next 3 years. And I wanted to ask you about, just before the break, we were talking about the idea of a cure and how much of that research hinges on trials and funding. And I wanted to just ask you about what the landscape looks like now. Are there, I mean, we were talking earlier about the cancer, kind of using cancer as maybe a similar situation. You were using that as an analogy of maybe cancer in the 1960s. Cancer is really well studied and it's really well researched, and there's a lot of money into different types of cancer. I wonder how you think ALS research is by comparison.
It's a growing field, I think, is the best way to answer that. So when you look at oncology, that is kind of held up as the gold standard that everyone wants to look at and find a way to emulate or adapt to whatever particular disease area that they're in. For almost every disease space, NIH is a huge source of funding. So when we talk about that $100 million number, that includes both, you know, philanthropic donations that are raised through that grassroots campaign that we want to build over time as a movement through IMALS, but it also includes additional funding from NIH, because NIH will actually give a lot of money every year to different granting requests that deal with every single disease under the sun. Right now, ALS represents a very, very small percentage of that overall budget. And so our goal is to be able to increase that percentage. So that we can achieve parity in terms of the research dollars with other terminal illnesses out there. And so for us, a big part of the initial question with IMALS is, how do we get that message out there to folks that if we just get more funding, we can actually find a cure? And that's not just a sort of aspirational tagline. That's
right, isn't kind of like a moonshot thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, if I had sat here and said that, you know, someone would have called and said that's a moonshot idea. I can't sit here today and say we're going to have a cure tomorrow, but I can sit here to your question and say that doctors across the country and across the world are looking at different biomarkers, different levels of whatever in my body, and they're looking at different compounds, and they're trying to identify which one of those compounds, which one of those biomarkers is going to actually crack the code to answering ALS. And the steps that have been made in the last 10 years, 5 years, have been incredible, vis-a-vis where we were 80 years ago. You know, when Lou Gehrig was diagnosed, there was absolutely nothing out there. I can sit here today and say that I have hope that within my lifetime, I can see a cure or a curative cocktail for this disease. That's something that we couldn't have said 20 years ago. And that's why this campaign becomes so important, because there are many incredible causes out there. For us, what we want people to take away from this discussion, and obviously the work that we're doing, is join us, help cure this thing, help move this disease into that encyclopedia of cured illnesses, and then let's move on together to the next one, and the next one, and the next one.
And so part of the work you're doing with I Am ALS is also making people aware of clinical trials, people with ALS, letting them know about opportunities?
Yes, and part of the difficulty that many ALS patients face is they don't live a mile away from the best ALS center in their neighborhood. You know, many folks may have to travel, you know, tens of hundreds of miles to actually get someplace that actually knows how to treat an ALS patient or is offering a clinical trial.
If you're in Illinois and you're diagnosed with ALS, where do you go for treatment?
You know, there are ALS centers, you know, at the university. So in the center of the state, there's a number up here in Chicago. There's a number down in St. Louis. But, you know, many patients are driving 3, 4, 5 hours to actually get to a clinical trial. And one of the new developments that, you know, gives us hope is doctors have recognized that, and they're trying to find ways to design trials that actually allow you to be in a trial from your home or from your local doctor's office. Obviously, that comes with some complications to it, but that's a big thing, and that enables you as an ALS patient to keep living your life, but also be a part of the advances that we need to find a cure for this thing.
Do you think, or based on the research, do we think eventually a cure will come from stem cell research?
I think that that's one of the, you know, promising areas. There are a couple of trials going on right now into that question. I think much like HIV, you know, took a cocktail of different drugs, it's probably going to be true for ALS. And what I mean by that is no two ALS patients progress the same way. And so for each patient, you have to be able to go and find out a little bit about them and then be able to treat them. So the good news is the more weapons we have to treat folks, the more we're going to be able to slow down every variety of ALS, and the more we're going to be able to move towards one or two overall omnibus treatments that actually can cure it in one fell swoop. But in the interim, while we're looking for those, finding a different drug every year that could help keep us alive, not a bad thing.
You mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that a cure for this would have ramification for other degenerative diseases, and you mentioned Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I was surprised, actually, when I started talking to doctors and asking the question of, does ALS have any tie to any other disease out there? And the answer I got over and over again was actually, yes, a lot. And part of that is the major issues that are at play in many ALS patients are in this sort of motor neurocortex of the brain. And for many others who are suffering from Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, there are other complications that also start in that area that involve aspects of dementia, aspects of the degradation of the motor neurons. And the commonality there means that if you actually find a cure for one, that curative cocktail can actually help unlock cures for others. The good news and bad news about ALS, bad news for patients, good news for doctors, is that it progresses at the fastest rate of all those different diseases. What that means is that if you want to set up a clinical trial, it can show you in the shortest amount of time whether or not a drug is effective. And so that's why, you know, I say if you cure ALS, you can actually unlock these other disease answers, because, you know, we'll be able to find out quickly if a drug works. And if it works for ALS, we can repurpose it and try it in other diseases soon after.
You mentioned at the beginning of this also that you want this to be, in some ways, a grassroots movement, your organization, IAMALS. How do you want people who are listening to get involved?
Join us. Go to our website, www.imals.org. Follow us on Twitter at imals.org. Follow us on Facebook. You don't have to go online and become a large donor. You don't even have to go online and start posting about this every day. But our hope and our belief is that if you sign up, if you follow us, you'll find some way to join us. You'll find something that moves you. And once you take that first step, we want to bring you into the fold, not just for one time, but to become a part of this family, become a part of this movement, and help us find a cure for this thing finally.
You said that one of the things that you don't want people to feel is what people often feel when they get a diagnosis, which is that they're not alone. And I wonder, as you've started this organization and as you've connected with people with ALS, probably not just around the country, but the world, I wonder what stories stick out to you.
There are the heart-wrenching stories of a 9-year-old girl who I met who was diagnosed with ALS. Those ones, you know, can't help but haunt you. But there are also the stories that actually make you smile of, individuals who do incredible things in response to their diagnosis. I'm thinking of one person in particular who made a viral Ice Bucket Challenge video. He happens to be from a family that has genetic ALS. And he took a video of himself in underwear that had a couple of choice words on it while he was washing his car with that underwear. It's one of those moments where you realize that when you get diagnosed with a disease like breast cancer or ALS, you don't stop being the person that you were the day before your diagnosis. And I'm reminded of that on a daily basis. And that's one of the most inspiring things about the patients and caregivers that we meet. They're incredible souls who've led incredible lives and will continue to do so. And part of our mission with IAMALS is to remind everyone of that fact. They are your sisters, your brothers, your friends, your neighbors. That's why we want you involved in this fight.
I wonder how you combat. Thank you for sharing all of that. And I think a lot of people will find inspiration from that. But I also wonder about when you're diagnosed with a disease, it's a really tough thing for a lot of people to deal with, and people don't know how to handle it. I feel like we're not really great in American culture about handling sort of suffering or bad things because we always want everything to be okay. So I wonder how having ALS has changed your perspective on interactions with people on a day-to-day basis.
We deal with illness in the shadows. You know, you get diagnosed in a room with a doctor. You live most of your life in a small windowless room with nurses doing testing. For me, one of the biggest takeaways is that we all carry burdens, and that's important for us to remember. Some burdens are obvious, some are not. And so it has made me appreciate in a way that I hope that I did before, but definitely more cognizant of now, how every interaction with a person leaves the chance for them to leave feeling a little bit better about themselves. So when you meet a person with ALS, if they're in a wheelchair, if they're otherwise sort of disabled, don't avert your eyes, don't look away. They're the same as they were before. They act slightly differently, they operate slightly differently, but they are living a life just with some different challenges. And so, you know, the people that I've met who've come up to me, give me a big hug and said, good luck, love you, are amazing. They make you smile all day long.
That was Brian Wallach speaking with Nyla Boodoo back in February about his organization, I Am ALS. Tomorrow on the 21st, it's Election Day in many cities and towns across Illinois, including Chicago, Champaign, and Springfield. If you're looking for more information on your local election or if you're unsure of your voting status, visit elections.il.gov. Don't forget to get out there and vote. The Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights will have legal volunteers ready to answer the phones if you run into any problems at your local polling place or if you just have questions. It's a nonpartisan election protection hotline. That number is 866-OUR-VOTE. That's 866-687-8683. They also have hotlines in 9 languages, including Spanish, Mandarin, and Arabic. We'll tweet out those numbers if you follow us on Twitter at 21STShow. We'll also have them at our website, 21stshow.org. We'll have local election results for you on Wednesday, but tomorrow we're taking a break from politics and bringing you some of our favorite conversations from this past year. Tax day is fast approaching. Have you filed your taxes yet? If not, don't worry. We'll hear from two tax experts who will give you all the information you need. Here's Carmi Gregory. She's a tax advisor with H&R Block in Sycamore in DeKalb County. She says if you're filing your own taxes, you have to be extra diligent, especially in light of changes under the new tax law.
If they're doing it themselves, then they need to be very careful that if they're doing like a babysitting form, that the right child's name, identification, birth date, and all is properly placed in there. If they're doing an education form, that they make sure they get the correct child's information put into there so that it follows on through with what they have going on in their return.
We'll also be revisiting our conversation about Real Midwest, a series featuring films that explore Midwest stories and directors. Here are David Rocchio and Arlen Parsa talking about what it's like to be making films away from the coasts.
I think it's much harder to be distal, but I think it's much more interesting to find work that maybe you don't get pushed into doing because of what the market's dictating.
I'll tell you the truth. You know, David and I both work in nonfiction and documentary, and we know that there's stories to be told all over the country, all over the world. And I think geography doesn't need to be a restricting factor in the same way that maybe it was many years ago.
Stay tuned this whole week for some of our favorite interviews from the past year. We're out of time for today. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments about what you want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there. They're also available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most places you get your podcasts. We're also now on Spotify. Check us out there for episodes every Monday through Thursday afternoon. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.